Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Casterbrus podcast. Yes, with a K. Available on casterbrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and audio boo. It all started as a mild curiosity by these Casterbrites, and now it's turned into quite a spirit of adventure, don't you think? Listen.
Hello, everyone. If you're listening to this, well,
hello.
You... Hey.
Hi. How are you
doing? Listening to this? You must know where you are if you're listening to it right now.
I know. I didn't. I neither downloaded it nor pressed play on the website, and here I am listening to it.
That's crazy. So you're one of the unlucky ones, I assume. You found us by accident.
I think so. I think I deserve an apology.
Yes. Well, you're not going to get one because it's not that kind of show today. You know why? Because today is the James and Brian show. That's right. We are without Christian. And that's where we are. If you're listening right now, you've downloaded us. You've streamed us. You know the deal. We're probably going to drone on about Christian. Sci-fi things. Probably Doctor Who. Might be Doctor Who. I don't know. A lot of Doctor Who in there. And yeah, I think that's what we're going to do today.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
If there are just a small caveat, if there's any problems in the recording, the sound of this, we're very sorry. There are a few technical issues my end, so we will muddle through the best we can. I think we have absolutely zero idea what we're talking about this week.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, it's a good thing that you actually found the podcast by accident, because if you didn't, who'd be recording this week?
That's a very good point. I think there's some sort of recursion going on there that is quite exciting in a vaguely sexual and testicular way. I don't know. So, we talk about Doctor Who generally, don't we?
Yes, I think that is the thing we talk about.
Doctor Who stuff. You know, I've... Do you know what? Recommendations. He's
that
not here.
That's crazy talk.
Boys can go out to play. James and Brian show, and I noticed how you alphabeticized me before you, which is kind of cool.
Yes, well, you know.
I'm going to go with recommendations to start. And I'm because I've watched The Ambassadors of Death this week.
Get out. I'm watching The Ambassadors of Death right now.
Really?
I really am. I'm on episode 4 right now.
Episode 4. I just finished episode 7 yesterday.
Weird. We didn't even plan that.
We didn't even plan it. Didn't even plan this podcast either. It just happens.
We might have something to talk about now.
Wow. Oh, cool. Well, at least we can talk about episodes 1 to 4.
Well, yes.
Absolutely. So how are you finding it?
You know, I'm really enjoying it. As a matter of fact, I actually, when I put it on, instead of starting with the show, I was starting with the extras. I was working on some photography projects here, and I wanted noise in the background. I generally like to hear talking sometimes rather than music, and I just let a lot of Doctor Who extras play. And I was on Towns Wang Chiang, so I there's 3 discs worth of extras there. And when they were finished, I'm like, no, I'm not done listening to these things. So I put that on, and I was very interested in some of the things they had to say about the story. I knew I was going to watch it. I pulled it out to watch it, but somehow it got me more interested in the story, hearing all the things, how like they were just throwing in stunts in certain scenes, like last minute. They kind of almost wrote it on the fly, in a sense. The Ambassadors of Death, of course, that is.
Go on. I was going to say, it's pretty incredible, especially given it's very odd, patchy creation.
Yeah.
You know, David Whittaker, then from David Whittaker on to Hulk and Dix to finish off and sort out the teething issues. But it holds up very, very well. Funnily enough, I remember watching this when I was about 11 on a videotape and finding it really boring. Yet now, I think it's really good.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm very glad to see that it's been colorized, but at the same time, I'm kind of a little bummed out that it's one of those ones that went missing, because I would love to see it in its full glory and its full proper color and clarity, you know, but something about it, something with that film feel, it's definitely got that season 7 feel to it completely, which just really works for it. I really like the story. I like the concept. I like the characters a lot. And again, like I said, finding out like certain backstory things just made it a tad more interesting to me. Even unfortunately, there was one stunt accident where production assistant had gotten hurt, which I found that obviously that was sad. Everybody said that was a very sad moment and so on. But they said there were certain precautions they should have taken that they didn't know about or something like that. It was very weird when you consider these people are making this show now, particularly for 7 years, and certain things like that still they don't have protocols for, I guess. You know what I mean?
I suppose you're always so much on the fly, and you know it's a time where health and safety is at a different evolutionary state in television. I imagine sometimes, you know, these things can just be overlooked in the sheer sheer quantity of things going on at once.
Yeah.
But no, it's an interesting story, and it's an interesting story in the sense it goes back to what we were talking about a few months ago. I'm trying to think if you were in on this one or whether it was me and Corley. It was about how it was it could have been the start of a very different Poe era, because it feels like it feels like something more like the 60s. You know, it's got that sort of event, that sort of almost feeling of Avengers with a sort of 70s Quatermass. Well, Quatermass was earlier than the 70s, obviously, but it has that sort of Quatermass feel with a little bit of the Avengers mixed in. It's a very different show to what Troughton was doing.
Yeah, you know, actually, now that you mentioned that one of the only things that actually really felt, I guess, more like the later direction of the Pertwee era was the interior shots for his console room.
Yes.
If you know what I mean, like those scenes there felt like they actually came from a later season than this particular season. It didn't seem right to me. Like, it's not bad, but it didn't feel like it belonged in this season somehow watching it.
Yeah, no, it is very odd. And again, from our sort of point of view as a prop enthusiasts, it's quite interesting to see how awful the prop looks. It doesn't look quite as bad as it does in Inferno, but
no.
It obviously takes a bit of a battering
at
some point. But yeah, it's very interesting seeing the console there, because it is a hark back to an era, and an era to come as well, as you say, that just in this period just doesn't really exist. It's a totally different show, really.
Sure.
The Brigadier's relationship is very interesting, which again harks back to some of our talks over, you know, the Brigadier series or book series that's you know hitting the stands. His relationship with the Brigadier is far less tempestuous, less abrasive. It's actually a lot warmer in these early series, in this first series, than it is in the next ones, where it almost seems like the Doctor can't stand the guy to some degree. Do you feel that?
You know, it is a little weird to hear you say that, because I do agree. Like, it does seem like he is getting along pretty well with him, which is, in a sense, a little bit odd, because they do make a nod back to the previous story where, you know, the Doctor is still kind of either bitter or taking a dig at the Brigadier for blowing up the Silurians.
Yeah.
So you'd think that his kind of distaste for him or just his short temper with him anyway would have started taking effect right there rather than later on. But it seems like he was upset that they blew up the Silurians, and then the next episode, the next story rather, they're just kind of cool with each other again. So it's almost like they did the old classic reset button there, whereas later on they thought maybe the Doctor wouldn't necessarily get on with him completely all the time, you know, later on, and started working that in.
And it's quite interesting how there is only one reference to sort of negative reference to the Brigadier is obviously to the Silurian story, which was prior to it, which is kind of interesting, because it's not something you tend to really get in TV shows in this sort of period, or certainly not in American ones, maybe a little more in British, where there is that callback to a previous story, the previous story, where he sort of references this, blowing up the Silurians and the Brigadier.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of weird, because when I was watching it, admittedly, it's one of those eras where for some reason I can never remember which story comes before which. I know where Spearhead from Space falls, obviously, but I keep forgetting which order the rest are in. So I kept trying to figure out when I first put it on, like, where does this fall? Like, what am I supposed to be knowing at this point? And then when they said that, I'm like, oh, well, it's definitely after the Sardaurians. But it was weird that just getting that kind of note, that nod, because you're right. You don't normally get them talking about the previous adventure. And it's weird because I guess I didn't realize how odd that was at first when they said it. It made me just think a little bit more, like, why is the Doctor being so friendly towards him? I would have thought right now he should be a little standoffish and then have to be coaxed into working to help these astronauts, or into this situation, rather.
Which is often the way later on in the second movie series, it's more that's to approach.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's more focused on his main goal, which is getting the heck off Earth.
I think what's quite interesting is that it's not unlike a lot of Doctor Who moments where they call back to previous episodes. It feels like a sort of almost quite an advanced narrative approach, in the sense it's almost trying to say, yes, we know we left the last episode with the Doctor and the Brigadier not in a very good place. We're not really going to carry that through, but we are aware of that at the same time, which is a sort of slightly advanced way of sort of talking to the audience, in sort of setting the tone that, yeah, see, we are aware that there was a lot of aggression at the end of the last one, a lot of abrasion, but we are aware of that. But here we are, we're moving on. So I think that's quite interesting with Silurians and Ambassadors of Death.
Yeah, that's actually quite a good point too, because I know Terrence Dix had talked about, like, kind of the reset button kind of thing before. So to find here that they're actually acknowledging it, now even makes it more interesting that they would bother to bring that up. But I like it. It's a good character thing, because the way it was said, the Doctor kind of just basically said, "What, didn't he do enough after blowing up the Silurians?" So he was still a little bit like, come on, the guy's already just done something horrible. What's he going to do now? Kind of thing. But without really, like, getting full force into the actual morality issues of it, So it was interesting.
No, so it's a good story. I mean, obviously, we won't just hark on totally about Ambassadors of Death this week, but maybe we'll come back to it. But I really enjoyed it. It doesn't feel particularly like David Whittaker. So how much it's changed through Dix and Hulk, it feels more like Hulk than it does Whittaker to me. But maybe that's, I'm not sure.
With that sort of thing, I'm not 100% sure. I can tell. Like, I think I would maybe know somebody like, oh my God, all of a sudden his name is completely escaping me.
Not editing this out, you can stew in your own ignorance. Idea.
I just can't get it. Okay, yeah.
Give me a clue. Good sake.
He's the damn good writer who always writes those cool comedic characters. Thank you, Robert Holmes. Why was that not in my head?
Why didn't you just ask me? It was an obvious one.
I know it was an obvious one. But, like, so he's somebody that I can generally tell, he's written the story. A lot of times when I watch some of these stories, because the classic series had so many writers, I don't know every one of them, I guess as much as I know some of the more heavy hitters kind of thing. So when I see certain people's stories, I don't immediately think of their writing style. I just know I'm enjoying what I'm watching. So sometimes I'll pull the cover out to go look and see who wrote it, and either be surprised, like, oh, I probably should have known that, or that's amazing, I don't even recognize this name. And it's kind of sad probably to say that, but some of these stories, I really just don't realize who these people were, or don't remember these names, I guess because I got more interested in writing later on in life. So when I first was really watching this show, the characters in the stories obviously were important, but it wasn't as important to me that the person that wrote them, like that aspect, I started picking up on that later in life. And I guess I'm still kind of working my way through getting to know all of the writers and their particular styles as I learn more about writing, being more involved with filmmaking. So I don't know if I would have picked up particularly on a flavor for this, but I will say the director of this particular story, Michael Ferguson, he did something I found interesting, and it was either episode 1 or 2. And this is something that he talked about in the special features. But apparently, you know that shootout that was in the warehouse?
Yeah.
In that scene, he said, you know, they pretty much just took a bunch of guys, put them in a warehouse, told them all to shoot at each other and run around, and they'll film it. And they said, don't worry, we'll just film it, just go. And it's amazing because it really makes it look like it's an actual free-for-all, like all these people are really scrambling for their lives. You know, they're going to get caught, or we have to catch them or something. It looks more like how I would think these things would actually go down than an actual choreographed shootout. And I found that very interesting because for years I've always wondered, you know, what a fight scene on film would look like if they just let two people go at it properly, you know, like reality. Because if you've ever seen actually like two people actually fight, it's a lot of ridiculousness. It's a lot of stupidity. Like there's none of this. It doesn't look cool like it does in the movies, you know. So to hear that he chose that direction rather than try and make it look cool, and yet it still worked out very well on film, and obviously probably because of him choosing angles and shots and editing. But just to see that it worked surprised me, and I was actually glad to see that, since I had thought about it for years and I didn't even know that about this scene until watching that extra just the other day.
Do you think? I mean, it calls us back to the same debate we've had again, but then, you know, we've been doing this for years now, so it's going to happen. Sort of how good, unsurprisingly, how good Capaldi would be in this sort of story. This sort of story format would work very nicely for his sort of doctor. Ambassadors of Death with Capaldi rather than Pertwee would seem to fit very well, and with that extra shine to the script that you get with these modern day scripts.
You know, it might work. There was a sense that for Series 8, they kind of slowed things down, and a lot of people felt it was because Capaldi was older and maybe couldn't do all the running around or whatever that his predecessors could, which who knows if that's true or not. But there is something about the fact that his doctor is older in the sense that he's a little bit more experienced in reserve, and therefore this type of pacing. Because one thing I noticed about this is another one of those 7-part stories, you know, and I'm not sitting here watching this going, oh, God, you know, there's another episode.
Exactly.
You know, it's never. It's just, oh, I want to put that next episode on now.
Yeah.
You know? We always talk about how these stories could use more time to breathe. And I think taking away the 2-parters in Matt Smith's era maybe was fine for him. Because, you know, he was a fast actor and he probably plowed through stories very easily. But with Peter Capaldi, the stories could have more room to breathe. And not to say that he couldn't do the fast ones easily either, but it seems like he could put more into a lengthy story, you know, more depth into it to make us really be sitting there and enjoying that story thoroughly, because we have more of it to enjoy, but we also have somebody who's giving us more to enjoy. Without downplaying Matt Smith yet again, I just think that would be something Capaldi would be great at. It would be very nice to have more time in a world like here. We're getting to know so many of the characters in the Ambassador of Death, and the sets. You know, we're used to these sets. We're used to these people. We're getting to see how deep some of their deceit goes down, rather than just finding out in 2 seconds they were a bad guy and now they're done. You know, like some of them come in and come out, you know, and go back again, and it's really detailed, and we just don't get that. And I would love to see that. And I think maybe Peter is the right one for that right now.
I mean, with Ambassadors, there's a lot of political intrigue, which gives it an extra layer. Because, I mean, I was just thinking about it. Most of the multi 5 to 7 episode stories can suffer because they can end up a bit like Seeds of Doom does, where you're sort of stuck in the same area going backwards and forth for 4 episodes. Between sort of 2 spots, and there is a bit of that in Ambassadors of Death. You know, the sort of central hideout where they've got the ambassadors, the main space lab, and that's really about it. And there is a bit of tossing and frame, but there's enough political intrigue within the characters within the story that just doesn't make it feel like it's like Seeds of Doom, where it sort of just goes back between 2 points, rushing backwards and forth. It feels like, because you're never quite sure if you're watching it cold who is going to definitely be the motivator of all this. and their reason for doing it either, which doesn't sort of become clear till episode 7. So there is a lot of confusion. There is a lot of emotional drama there, which is unusual for Doctor Who, which I think makes it work.
Yeah, and I think another thing that works really well too is we get to see how the Doctor works.
Yes,
he's working really hard with Liz's life is in danger, and you know they say, you know, present yourself to us or stop what you're doing rather, or we're going to kill her, and he's just going to go ahead and do what he's doing because, you know, in his mind, who's going to let them know what I'm doing unless you're a spy or you're a spy, you know? But really, the more important thing here is right now, I need to know what this message is. And in order to find out what this message is, I have to build this device that will read this message. And it's great. It's not just a wave of the sonic screwdriver. It's not just a 2 second, well, I know what this thing is, human, so you don't know what this is. Here it is. Let me tell you. No, it's, I know there's something going on here, but I really need to work hard to figure it out or else we're going to lose this one. You know, and you're getting to see all the scientific means that he knows, and not even just for the message, but, you know, when, you know, and I'm not at that particular episode yet, but when he goes out into space himself, you know, you get to see that he is an astronaut. He knows about all that science, trying to bring the astronauts back down to Earth. He's got a big plan for that. He again knows how all the science works there, and you just get to see how his brain works. And I think, as I've said before, that was one of the things that always attracted me to the heroes that I grew up enjoying, you know, Spider-Man, Doctor Who, MacGyver, in a sense, even Indiana Jones, all these characters who kind of, you know, use their intelligence, you know, Indiana Jones probably less so because he was more of a gun-toting guy, but he was still a very intelligent man, you know, and I always found those things to be more interesting than just some guy who would walk in a room, shoot him up, and save the day. And while we do get a lot of the Doctor being smart in the new series, it's at the expense a lot of times of the audience and the characters around them feeling dumb, rather than the Doctor sitting here kind of explaining what he's doing and teaching you a process. And maybe you can't replicate it at home, but he's filling you in and you're sitting there going, this is pretty interesting. You know, you figured this out and now you're building this machine. And you know, maybe I can't build the machine the same way as you, but I see what you're doing. I understand what you're doing. So it's a great aspect of it. It's a great thing to show the character's intelligence properly rather than just tell people he's intelligent, I guess, is probably the best way to say it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So it's a great story. It's a great one, as you say, for the Doctor, or a Doctor, maybe, because it gives him you never feel he's totally in control. He's always back-footed through most of it. That sort of feels a little unusual for Pertwee as well, which I think also works well for his Doctor. So if you've not seen Ambassadors of Death, do watch it. I think it is, I wouldn't say it's underrated because it is generally considered to be a very good story, but it's perhaps not one that a lot of fans would naturally gravitate to, and possibly not new fans. I mean, if you're into Peter Capaldi and you're perhaps looking to why people talked about his relationship with Pertwee, I think that first series is probably the best example of where Pertwee and Capaldi do have some sort of crossovers. So, yes, I mean, given that obviously we're both watching Ambassadors of Death, that is our recommendations for the week, is the Ambassadors of Death, which is rather cool. Cool indeed. I would like to, at this point, just mention there's an episode of New Who, in the first series, Series 1, The empty child, where Rose sort of makes a point that the Doctor's not really giving her any sort of Mr. Spock.
Yes.
And she is, of course, relating to the technology factor rather than any other euphemisms you might want to take from what I just said. And obviously this week we kind of felt that you've probably not been indulged enough by the constant deluge of love towards the actor Leonard Nimoy, who passed away just a couple of days ago, and Facebook just and all the other social medias just went absolutely crazy, and it's been quite amazing, in some ways amazing, some ways I don't like it, but I understand. But it's very fascinating to see how it's sort of how a character actor can resonate so much with such a global community. It's mind-boggling and socially significant as well. Did you see the Did you see the shot from the International Space Station with the astronaut doing the Vulcan Live Long and Prosper
Yeah,
with
absolutely.
his hands down directly above Boston as well, where Leonard Nimoy came from. It's you know, when it gets to that sort of level, it's staggering, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's incredible when you see fandom kind of embrace situations like that rather than just you know, have it mean nothing. It could very easily just be some people watch a show and that's it, and forget that the how hard these people worked to bring us entertainment, you know. So it is great to see that somebody, certainly somebody that you admire as well, when you see how many other people feel the same way. As you said, it was all over social media, so it wasn't something you could escape. But yeah, it was a sad day. I mean, you know.
I think what's sad about these sort of things, and this is by in no means to demean people's respect for the man dying and his family and everything else, but a lot of it is to do with the people and who are actually it's, who are posting more than it is about the man in a weird way, because it's how the identity of that man has had such significance on their life, if you see
Oh,
what I
yeah.
mean. It's sort of inverted in a lot of ways. There's a lot of respect for the person, but a lot of it is about seeing how people respond in a different way to, say, someone else dying, because it's like something that's encoded in them by this point. I mean, it's people of our generation especially, where you've had sort of 40 odd years of this car of this person that you've seen in everything, virtually every day, especially if you're into science fiction, you'll have seen Spock somewhere on some thing or another. So it's a very powerful part of your encoding. And suddenly this is so it's odd that, isn't it? It's a two-way thing.
Yeah, there's also one of the most, I guess, fascinating things, to use a Spock phrase there, for me, was seeing how many people would post up, you know, how, say, for instance, Spock changed their life. You know, so now you're not exactly talking about Leonard Nimoy himself. While it is still Leonard Nimoy, of course, you're talking about his work, something that he
Yes,
did, a character
exactly.
that he played, changing your life. So how this particular character, who really isn't Leonard Nimoy, because I mean, the guy couldn't be further from a human, essentially, or from what we know of Leonard Nimoy, but he's still a great guy, you know, he's still a great character. But then you get other people who post up about Leonard's personal life and his personal projects and the things that he believed in and how those things changed their lives and fueled, you know, their imagination. And that is the amazing thing. Something, and it's really incredible that I'd never thought of this before. With all of the actors that we have lost, with all the people that I admire and respect that we have lost, until seeing it now with Leonard, was the fact that they have such a, I don't know, such a full life already with entertaining us, with giving us so much pleasure. But not only do they do that by being who they are naturally as Leonard Nimoy, but with all these various characters that they play, they have touched other people's lives and inspired them in other ways. So rather than, in essence, being one person, like say right now, you or I are one person. We don't have alter egos. We're not actors out there, essentially, who people get to know. Because I guess the best way to say it, growing up watching Star Trek, I knew Spock before I ever knew Leonard Nimoy. You know, so I knew Spock. Spock was a man unto himself. So now that Spock is dead with the death of Leonard Nimoy, it's weird to see that Spock and Leonard Nimoy have both affected me in very different ways, despite the fact that they're the same man. This one man can affect you and touch your lives in different ways by being different people. And I'm not sure I'm expressing this the way I want, but I find it just incredible to think that this legacy can be left behind many times over by one person.
But this is something, funnily enough, totally just by coincidence, riffing off something that Nimoy himself and Shatner were talking about on the Star Trek 4 commentary, where Shatner points out how he finds it mind-boggling to know that his character, Kirk, will outlive him, that work will outlive either him or Leonard, which obviously he, at the time was totally without thinking about this, but and it in a sense, you know, you're right, you know, Spock has sort of died, but in a way he hasn't, because there is an immortality to him, to these sort of characters that they've helped generate, that take, you know, it's funny in a weird way, you know, talking about this now, to me, because I still watch Patrick Troughton as a second Doctor, Patrick Troughton still sort of lives in a weird way, because I don't know him.
Sure.
He is as Patrick Troughton to me is as abstract as the second Doctor, so I don't think my mind really ever sees him as a dead person in a lot of ways. If I went and saw his grave, it'd be different. But he is to me as real as the Doctor is, because I know he is a character. And I suppose that's the same with all of us. I mean, in a sense, we do have personas. I mean, what we do on here, to some degree, is a minor difference to who we are outside of here. So, you know, even we have a certain amount of everyone sort of has a certain persona, depending, obviously, with who they are, who they're talking to.
Sure.
You know, we see fractions of everyone, which is, again, makes it even more fascinating. And actors amplify that through their roles. And there are, as he corrected himself in his second book, I am Spock, rather than the first, where he was not, you know, where he acknowledges that Spock is a facet of him. There is a facet of him that is portrayed through Spock. And so, you know, he sort of seeds himself in all these variety bits of work, which is why I always think that being a cult actor is so amazing, because you do leave a legacy unlike any other role. You know, I'm looking at my DVDs that are sitting on my desk right now, and I've got Peter Davison's Campion sitting there.
Nice.
And I'm thinking, yeah, it's a brilliant role. I loved him in it. Yeah, he won't really be remembered for that. He'll be remembered for the Fifth Doctor, or even the cow thing in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy over Campion, which is, you know, in a lot of ways is a literary character which he brings to life of another person's work. You know, it's a far more critically serious embodiment of an actor's work, and that takes sidestep to Doctor Who, which he'll be his legacy, and that is kind of cool. And it goes back to that whole thing of even Caroline Ford, as we were saying the other week, you know, complaining as she obviously feels frustrated sometimes, that she wonders whether her career would have gone in a different ways if it hadn't been for Doctor Who. Did it dead end her? And you think, yeah, well, even if it did, you now have a legacy that I would think is highly improbable that you'd have had with any other roles. You will have an immortality, a pop culture immortality to some degree, which you would not have if you hadn't done Doctor Who. And, you know, not affected people. I mean, DeForest Kelly, Dr. McCoy, he said at one point that, you know, sometimes he, I think this, I read this on Wikipedia the other day, so it might be wrong, but he said that he was always worried that on his gravestone it would say he's dead, Jim, as a sort of off joke of how, you know, Star Trek is just sort of dominates him. And yet at the same time, he would also say how he was so touched at how Dr. McCoy enthuse so many people to go into medicine, in the same way that you've heard various doctors say the same thing about science. The repercussions that flood out these roles, and then, you know, things like social media really brings it to light. I think it's also, people have a fear of mortality. I think seeing Leonard Nimoy die, he is to them as immortal as Spock is. And I think when we see people like that who have existed as icons throughout our lives vanish, whether they be Leonard Nimoy or the Brigadier or Lishore, if we're going to sort of go down the Ambassadors of Death route, it's hard for people to reconcile. And I think that generates more emotion, because it's like a part of their childhood dying.
Right there, the part of your childhood. I would also say the part of your family.
Yeah.
Because for me, growing up, Star Trek and Doctor Who, you know, they in a sense were my family, you know. You know, not to say obviously I have real family, but I knew those shows inside and out. I knew those characters, and I loved those Star Trek movies. They're still to this day my favorite Star Trek movies are the classic crew.
Oh yeah, definitely. Know,
they're just the best. Yeah.
Well, it's not that much to actually say that, really, because the others haven't exactly been brilliant to compete with, but yeah.
Well, you know, there are some that prefer Next Generation, or even television wise, they prefer Voyager and so on. Yeah, it's up to them. That's their choice. But I agree with you on the whole. I think most people feel that way. But there was just something like for instance, not that long ago, I was showing my girlfriend the Star Trek movies because she really she'd watched them or seen them or some of them or whatever, but she really didn't know much about them, and she's really enjoying them. And I kept wanting to get back to it, and it's a little sad that when Leonard passed, you know, my thought was, well, maybe we should get back to that. Like, sad because that's what it kind of took to get me back on that track, but also nice to honor him that way. So I ended up watching an episode instead because she wasn't available. But there's just something about them. I know them. I know those characters. I love those characters. I feel this is going to sound like I'm one of those crazy fans, but I feel like I'm friends with those characters in some way, because when they make a joke, I feel like I'm in it with them.
Oh, absolutely.
Rather than just listening to it, you know?
Well, you know people in films more than you know your next door neighbor in a lot of cases.
Sure.
You know, they are more real to you than those people, and they give you more than those people do. And, you know, it's kind of cool that we're now more in an age where it's becoming more socially acceptable to recognize the power and influence of fiction and film and television on people, and how that informs us, and through us, how that informs our entertainment and our personalities. I mean, that's what is so crucial, is that these things affect us in so many ways, and for so long we've all knocked them aside as like embarrassing silliness. And the film and television industry has done the same, and understandable, because they're making these things at a fast rate. To them, they are just, you know, day-to-day headaches to get sorted and then out onto broadcast or out into the cinemas. So for them, I think sometimes they find it hard to understand how it becomes such an important thing. But they do inform us in ways far more than politics do, stupidly enough.
Yeah.
You know, people talk far more about what they saw at the cinema, or who they love in a film, or, you know, they'll wear their clothes will be reflective of something they've seen in a film, not from what a politician wears, or, you know, their choice of music may be affected by a film and television. It's a massively powerful, as I said, it goes back to this, the whole point of this is just again how potent social media has become at reflecting this. It's not that it's new, it's just so much easier to reflect and to sort of self-generate, because when you see more people feeling it, you feel okay feeling it, you feel okay expressing it, and so it grows. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. It really is.
What do you think it is about essentially the sci-fi fantasy, or even, I guess, we'll throw in adventure films and shows, because of characters such as Indiana Jones as well, I feel fall in there, even though technically I guess you could say some of that sci-fi as well with the paranormal stuff they've dealt with. But what do you think it is with that versus people watching their favorite cop drama TV show, or their favorite just everyday housewives, you know, normal lives TV show, we'll say, or soap operas, you know, that we get so attached to these people, to these characters. We watch them over and over again. We get so invested in their lives. We have conventions to go meet them. They have celebrity appearances that they will go do, but I don't see that happening for like people of sitcoms or police shows and so on. Like, what do you think it is about that? What's the difference? Why is it that this happens for this realm and this fandom and people like us?
That's
a tough question, but still.
It's a question where I think it's a question which is often asked. It's what makes, I mean, because science fiction is such an unusual genre that it carries an element of connection which you don't really get in anything bar soaps, maybe. People don't. I don't know. I sometimes wonder with science fiction. I wonder a lot of the time with what we watch. It's something to do with what we watch when we're young. And when we're young, I'm thinking like Star Trek with Nimoy and Spock. You know, I watched as a kid. Well, I mean, I love Homicide: Life on the Street. I think it's a fantastic show. I connect to those characters. I find them interesting. I'd love to see some of them come back again, although I know Munch is never away for long in various shows. But what you connect with the kid is, again, it goes back to that family thing, is who you grow up with. And I don't think you tend to grow up with cop shows. While with science fiction has an interest for kids because it's spectacle, it's something that's visual, it's energizing to kids on a simple level as well as the complex levels that it can be for adults. And I think that engagement means that you sort of gain an earlier rooting. I think that's why I think the power over people like over science fiction, over, and why Spock is such a different death. Spock, Leonard Nimoy's death has such a greater impact than I think you probably get when, you know, a Hollywood great like Al Pacino, God forbid, passes away. You know, fantastic actor, known for so many roles and embraced by everyone. I wonder if it will carry such a resonance.
That's a very good thought, because there are a lot of actors that I do really respect out in Hollywood who do so many very different roles. But somehow I do feel Leonard Nimoy had more of a personal connection to my life, you know, in that, I don't know, I know that Star Trek stuff inside and out, you know, and I think there's also something to be said for shows like, you know, I spoke about earlier, who were my heroes, you know, the people that were thinkers, that weren't necessarily fighters. And you can even say that about Star Trek, despite the fact that Kirk always took his shirt off for a good fight. They had the morality within the stories. And that's something that, you know, I did get with MacGyver and Spider-Man and Doctor Who and Star Trek. And I think not only was it good fun and good adventure, it was good life lessons. Like, you sat there, you enjoyed these people because they were good people. And you wanted to be like those people, you know, and now we get heroes with flaws, and that's fine. But this, somehow, these people, they were mentors. They taught us.
I think that's true. And I think there's also the human character. I think if they play particularly human roles, I mean, I was very upset when Bill Bixby died, primarily for his David Banner in The Incredible Hulk, which was a fairly long-running show, to be fair, and it had a few little spin-offs which weren't very good, but there was a sort of a beautiful humanity in the character, which I think connects you to him in a sort of certain level, which meant the passing of the actor, who from all intents and purposes was, you know, was apparently quite a human guy with flaws and good bits all together, but, you know, he was meant to be quite a nice guy. It somehow hits you more, maybe. And I think the same would be when William Russell, God forbid. Yeah, but just not talking about age, talking about the personality, the role that he represented was a similar sort of role of a kind, humane, intelligent, thoughtful, still an action, as you say, still action orientated. And I think that sort of humanity, and of course with Nimoy, Spock is the ultimate, isn't he? He is like the Doctor. In some ways he's more human than human.
Yeah.
Because he is constantly made aware of it. So maybe that is also a factor. It's not just who you grow up with, but maybe there has to be that sort of feeling of bonding, that feeling of to embrace something which is people we find hard to deal with ourselves.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to bring that up about Bill Bixby, because you made me most of what you were saying there, you made me feel the same way, like about Roger Moore. If one day when we learn of his passing, I'm going to feel that way, because while James Bond certainly was a killer, you know, I am very connected with the Saint, but regardless, his character, certainly the Saint, is a very caring guy, but through those shows and films, I watched countless interviews with Roger Moore. He's just a very nice man. He does very good things for this world, you know, and so I guess that's another thing. Like, we get to know the actual people, and it brings it back to what I was saying before, that not only have our lives been touched by the actor themselves, but many times over by the characters that they play in different ways. So it is interesting, especially with this comparison here, because, you know, James Bond is a fun character to watch, but he's not exactly the role model that I would want to be, in a sense, you know, whereas Roger Moore is somebody that I very much admire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know, that's, yeah. Yeah. So weird. So I guess on so many different levels we connect with these people.
Yeah, it is one of those situations which is fascinating and yet horrible. It's
Yes.
And it's quite, I think with Nimoy, which is also quite nice, is the way that he always seemed to be very much of a bridge towards in the dysfunctionality within that Star Trek nucleus,
yeah,
or of that original crew. And you see George Takei offering the similar sort of condolences. You see William Shatner at the other end, both of them very different people with different perspectives on their legacies. And yeah, he always was the, I remember reading in the, when they did the animated series in the 70s, and it was Nimoy who put down the, slammed the gauntlet down to make sure that Nichols and Takei got a role, because the Filmation were looking to limit the amount of costs in the crew. And he said he would not do it if they weren't involved, as I recall. So, and yet at the same time, best friends with William Shatner, which has always been a fascinating one, because they seem such different people. But
yeah, some people just get along, and some people can see past the things that other people can't. But well, it is, you know, and that's another thing that I've always been able to be friends with tons of different people. You know, stemming back as far as high school, you know, I was just where there were cliques in high school. There were the divides of the kids that were friends with each other. You know, you had the jocks, you had the preps, you had the geeks, you had the emo kids, all sorts of different things, you know. And somehow I was just friends with everybody. And maybe Leonard Nimoy rather strikes me that way. You know, he just can get along with people, and people can just see him for who him, and rather than see, oh, he's best friends with William Shatner and I have an issue with William Shatner, so therefore I'm going to have an issue with him. People just saw him for who he was, which is very incredible, which is very good. Just shows a true testament to who he was.
Absolutely. It's, it's always a shame when these sort of things happen. It's just life, I guess. But it's going to be interesting rewatching the those films and see whether they change your perspective rewatching them. I hope not. I was always very sad. I never got to meet DeForest Kelly. Actually, I never got to meet Leonard Nimoy, which is a shame. I could have once, actually, but I was low on money, and I think the autograph. Oh no, I don't think it was him. Was it? Was he there? I can't remember. Shatner was.
Yeah.
But sometimes I wonder if being a little thrifty is perhaps a bad move. But very, very sad. But thankfully at the moment, not that I recall any particular deaths in Doctor Who so far. New series, all very quiet on that front. They seem to be keeping things quite under wraps. Obviously, there was a Missy thing recently. Did you speak about that last week with Christian? I've not been able to, haven't had a chance to listen to the two of you gabble.
No, we didn't. We didn't speak about Missy. There was some talk on Facebook about it, the Casterbrus Facebook.
Yeah.
But we didn't really talk about that.
Did you want to offer any opinions to the listener, half listener?
Yeah, sure. Me first.
Yeah, you first.
Basically, I'll just echo what I did say on the Facebook group. I'm glad to see she's coming back, because I really enjoyed her performance. But I really hope that her coming back is connected to the last story that we saw, because I really feel while she was great, I feel that story was a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're in some way connected, that could show that the particular story that we just watched was some kind of twisted plan of hers that would all make sense within this new story.
So
I would be much happier that way.
So you're hoping that this this new story will change how you feel to the old one, that it will add, it will reconcile some of the problems that you had.
Yeah, like for instance, the first part of that story, the first episode, was actually rather good. The second part is where everything started to fall apart and her plot made no sense whatsoever, and it was just a mess. You know, it was, I still, you know, obviously I won't drone on about it, but I hate, you know, going with character deaths. If somebody were to resurrect Leonard Nimoy in a film as a Borg, I think fans would be in complete outrage by that. And that's exactly how I felt about Nick Courtney, the Brigadier, being resurrected as a Cyberman. And I feel it was very disrespectful. And it's you didn't even bring him back to do something great. You brought him back to kill the Master, which clearly didn't happen, as you're telling us, within this next season. So what good did you do? You brought him back for what? To get the doctor to give him a salute? What was the point of that? You know, it was disrespectful. And then the master having a plan to give the doctor a cyber army, it was weird. I think there's more to it personally, or maybe I just want to think there's more to it and hope there's more to it. What I think would be really cool is if we found out not only that whole time, the whole of maybe episode two, or even a good portion of episode one and two of that story, they have been within Missy's matrix slice. And I would even love to see that Last Christmas was a part of that, because Last Christmas was a dream within a dream within a dream. It would be incredible to turn back and go, you remember that one adventure that you watched? Well, guess what, audience? You and the doctor and Clara all had no idea, but it didn't really happen. You guys are stuck right now in the master's matrix slice, and while she's out there really trying to do her grand plan. And I think that would be incredible, because that to me would be more the master than somebody trying to give the doctor an army of Cybermen to win his affection back. It felt wrong. So I'm hoping when she comes back, it's connected and they clean things up. But if they just give us a good story with her too, obviously that would be worthwhile. I would just like to see her do something more masterly, I guess.
Yes.
So that's my feelings.
Well,
what about yourself?
Well, I'm not so bothered about the story. My concern is that I'm a little concerned that she just doesn't work with the Capaldi doctor, that the Capaldi doctor seemed to be weakened, or whether that was intentionally or just through however they wrote her. But she just didn't make Capaldi particularly enjoyable to watch. I don't know whether if she comes back in the same sort of over the top way and he continues to play the subdued, confused person, I'm not interested. I don't want her back. I like what she does. I think what she does well. But if they can't find the balance within the writing, I'm not that thrilled that she's returning. That's because he just seemed like, as we've said before, he just seemed like a weak old man through those last two episodes, bumbling around. I just couldn't reconcile him with the same guy who was in Time Heist or Listen.
Sure.
Just didn't seem like that person. And if that was just done so they could make Missy seem more, you know, unusual, crazy, or whatever. But I just don't like that. It feels a bit like how River Song sort of had to become so very powerful, and everyone had to sort of seem almost second fiddle in that sort of relationship. No. But we will see. We will see. We will not judge till we have seen, I am sure.
Absolutely. I don't want to judge it until I actually have something to see. Like, I am, when they announced she was coming back, the master to me is like the Daleks. I'm not like one of those people that feels they need to be given a rest or a break. For some reason, I'm just always excited when I see them. That said, the disappointment comes in when we get a story that's just not so hot, like, say, Victory of the Daleks. You know, I'm excited that they're back. I really want to see them. And then you go, oh, man, like I was excited to see you guys, you know. So. I think it's going to be a fun time, because I think she's a very talented actress, and I think she did a really great job when she was there. And I see what you're saying about Capaldi. They need to up the writing on him to bring his performance to match.
As we said before, they still need to work out what his doctor is, because it just doesn't feel like they know still. And that's a problem.
It did seem like for series 8, he was what fit that particular
yes,
story.
Exactly. He felt very malleable.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why Series 8 was very up and down for me. I enjoyed it more than I had enjoyed the previous 3 years, and I don't know why that was. Maybe it was Capaldi, maybe it was the writing, because I did feel the writing was tighter in many respects, but it really depended on the episode. Like, you would get one story where you're like, yes, more of that, please, and then the next week you'd get something that just didn't work. Mm. So I do hope that they find a good balance, a good mix for series 9. And yeah, I think I agree with you. I hope they find who he is and we get to really explore who he is a little bit more. And I really hope they dial back on the drama tension between the doctor and Clara as well. I know it's a little bit tough considering where things were left with the death of Danny, but I really would like to see these two people interact a little bit better, get along a little bit better, you know, be on each other's side a little bit more, rather than her kind of, you know, doing the teacher or the mother thing. You can't do that. Don't do that. You know, like, stuff's got to be done. You know, things have to be done to save the day. Bad things happen.
I think it's always funny when shows do that, which is fine because sometimes characters would act in certain ways like that. But it's when the show seems to almost endorse it as the right way that it becomes frustrating. And yeah, as we've said before, when she has a rant at him at the end of The Caretaker, I think it is. And, you know, everyone's like, it's almost as if the show feels that that's a just rant and he should feel admonished from this. And you think, oh, well, no. I don't feel that, and you get that a lot.
Yeah,
but yeah.
I think that's one of the big issues, not just with Moffat, but I think that the new series had. The writers get an idea, like for instance, in that moment, they needed us to feel what Clara was feeling. So by having Clara yell it, they were hoping that we would sit there and go, "Yep, we agree with Clara completely."
Yeah.
When we didn't, and it's just like in The Waters of Mars, when the Doctor made that choice to be the Time Lord Victorious, we were supposed to sit there and go, yeah, we totally see this. That was a right call, and now he should get punished because, you know, he did. And it's like, well, no, there was clearly another way. Like, your writing is not clever because you chose to ignore the better way, all because you wanted us to feel a certain way, which didn't work because you were just hoping by telling us to feel that way we would. And I think that's something that they really need to stop doing. Just because you may want to evoke a certain emotion because you think it would work good for a story, but if you can't make it work right, then you probably should change how you're telling that story.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they won't learn a thing. They haven't so far, have they, for the last 10 years? So why are they going to start? Why don't they listen to us? Reinformed fandom. Right. Well, I think we've pretty much rubbed ourselves up the right way. If you're waiting for the recommendations, then you should have been listening earlier.
Just rewind a bit.
Rewind to the beginning and you'll get it. If you don't want to, you don't want to rewind, it's The Invasion. And if that bores you, well, then you should have rewound and found it wasn't. So, you know, you've got a choice. And you've got a reason to go and re-listen to this. And God's sake, if anyone's listened to The Invasion like 12 weeks in a row, you know, you really do need to get a life, to not paraphrase Leonard Nimoy's close friend. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening, if you are still listening. I've enjoyed listening to this, Brian. I might tune in another week and see how you fare.
Well, good. I'm so glad that this little accidental happening of yours turned out to have a happy ending.
It did. But until then, goodbye.